You're listening to Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. This is the first of a two-part interview with Dr. John Knowles, an assistant professor of land atmosphere exchange in the Department of Land Resources and Environmental Sciences at Montana State University. His interdisciplinary research is broadly focused on how disturbances like drought, insect, fire, and climate change impact provisioning of ecosystem services throughout the western United States. He's particularly interested in bringing multi-scale lines of evidence to investigate feedbacks between carbon and water cycle processes. Dr. Knowles received his PhD from the University of Colorado Boulder and was a professor at California State University Chico before coming to MSU. Dr. Knowles, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Could you tell us a bit about your background? How did you get your start in ecohydrology?
My road to ecohydrology was a circuitous one. I'm from Portland, Maine. Grew up, by the ocean, but was never really drawn to ocean stuff. So actually didn't know what I wanted to do in undergrad and became a Spanish major. Mainly so I could study abroad for a year in Spain, which was awesome and has shaped the way I think about things in, you know, a lot of ways. But it was after undergrad, didn't know what I wanted to do for work. I moved up to, for me it was Vermont, to work at a ski area, and had fun doing that for a couple years, but kind of started to get frustrated with not using my brain as much in my day-to-day turning of valves and whatnot. And I found this course called Snow Hydrology, and it was being taught at University of Colorado, and it really grabbed me. And it was actually through talking with a friend from undergrad who had been a geology major, and we were just talking on the phone one day. I was like, hey, you know, I found this snow hydrology course. Like, you might think that's cool. And he said, you know, you got to talk to my family friend. He's in that field. Here's his phone number. Like, call him. And so it was through this, like, cold call of a person that I now know who's a federal scientist that does a lot of snow hydrology. Called him up a few days later, like 6 o'clock at his home. Said, hey, you don't know me. Would you mind talking to me about snow hydrology? And so he took right then and there like 45 minutes or an hour, talked me through a bunch of stuff. You know, I ended up going out to Boulder to see you. I took classes through continuing ed because I was a Spanish major and I needed science prereqs. And kind of through the course of figuring out what might be a good master's and then PhD, I'm still very interested in snow hydrology. But it kind of morphed into the interface between hydrology and ecosystems for me, which kind of coincides with ecohydrology becoming coined, I would say, as a term. Maybe 20, 25 years ago is when that kind of ecohydrology came onto the scene. And so I heard it, I started hearing it more, and started realizing that I identified with that a lot, and it's something that I've carried with me since grad school.
Thanks. Could you give us a quick definition of that term, ecohydrology?
Yeah, that's funny. I teach about this in class. There's a lot of definitions of ecohydrology. I think of it like a two-way street. And so one way to think about that would be, you know, how much ecosystems need water, right, to survive. Think of in Montana, right? Think of a forest or a rangeland. And so I'm interested in studying things like how an ecosystem is able to provide services based on how much or how little water maybe it received in that year's snow or summer rain, something like that. So water impacts on ecosystems. But in terms of the two-way street, one thing we don't always think about is all the water that's, for lack of a better word, sucked up by an ecosystem as it grows and ultimately transpired back out to the atmosphere, doesn't make it into our streams or reservoirs or our aquifers. That water's gone from the system. So in that way, it's kind of ecosystems regulating how much water is available for, in this case, water resources.
What are some examples of the questions that you hope to answer with your research?
That's a big question. I'm still, I'm an assistant professor. I'm finding my way as I go. And one of the, what I consider to be a strength that I bring is I do work on a lot of different systems and types of questions. So in my training, I mentioned I was at University of Colorado for a long time. I did postdoc work in Arizona. And then I had my first professor job at Chico State in Northern California before coming to MSU. So in terms of questions, like overarching questions, some of those have stayed the same, like how do ecosystems function, and how does that function regulate the provisioning of services like clean air, clean water, habitat for wildlife, etc. Also, how do things like disturbances, drought, fire, bark beetles, or climate change alter ecosystem functioning or provisioning of things like water resources? But I have worked on them in a big array of settings. So mountains in Colorado, deserts, rangelands, agriculture, I would argue can be thought of as a managed ecosystem. And so I do a fair amount of the same questions apply in agriculture. And then now that I'm here in Montana, I've got a forest site that I'm really excited to be studying and kind of branching out into additional sites from there.
I want to get into the specifics of the site. Your research utilizes a method called the eddy covariance technique for collecting data. How does this method work and what types of instrumentation does it use?
Really the backbone of my research is this method called eddy covariance. It involves two sensors that get mounted on an instrument tower, and the instrument tower has to be above the height of the vegetation canopy. So if we're working in a rangeland or an ag system, that instrument tower only has to be maybe, about a person height tall to be above the vegetation. If we're working in the forest, those two sensors have to be mounted quite high above the ground on some kind of either climb up or walk up style instrument tower. It's a meteorological method, meaning the sensors are measuring, in the case of eddy covariance, it's the wind as it passes by the sensors. So the method takes advantage of the fact that all the CO2 and the water vapor that are exchanged between Earth's surface and the atmosphere are contained in these turbulent eddies that are created by friction as wind passes over Earth's surface. And just like eddies in a river, air is a fluid, just like water. And so friction at the surface kind of causes the air, as a large scale air masses to roll over themselves and form all sizes of turbulent eddies in the atmosphere. So those eddies contain all the CO2 and all the water vapor that's involved in these processes of evapotranspiration and photosynthesis and respiration. And by measuring really fast, like 10 or 20 times per second, both of these sensors were able to calculate exactly how much CO2 and water vapor was exchanged in those processes. And the really cool thing about eddy covariance is because you're measuring up above Earth's surface on this tower of some height, that you can actually calculate the footprint or the contributing area of the CO2 and water vapor molecules that you're measuring. And you can kind of back calculate that to say what area of forest or rangeland or ag land that this signal that you're measuring is coming from. And for eddy covariance, it's typically on the scale of hundreds of meters to maybe on a tall tower, a full kilometer upwind. And so what that means is you're getting one number from our, you know, single set of tower-mounted sensors that's representative of the vertical, anyway, surface atmosphere exchange of CO2 and water vapor from an entire, you know, several hundred meters to kilometer patch of vegetation. Eddy covariance lends itself to pairing with lots of types of data. Mm-hmm. You could definitely compare with GIS, and maybe some kind of, you know, modeling happens a lot to say, okay, well, if things look like this from here, then we know from GIS that there's X percentage of other ecosystem patches that look like this, and we could maybe map those and assume that there's some similarities of behavior.
You mentioned that you've worked in a bunch of different ecosystems, and as I understand it, you currently have eddy covariance stations set up and monitoring data in a few different areas within the Northern Rockies and then possibly beyond as well. What ecosystems do you have stations in?
Yeah, the ecosystems that I have eddy covariance stations in really reflect a legacy of my academic journey. So during my master's degree, I set up two eddy covariance towers in alpine tundra at about 11,500 feet elevation in the Colorado Rocky Mountains. And those are still collecting continuous data some 17 or 18 years later. So they're actually the kind of the longest running, highest elevation eddy covariance towers in the world now. They've been kind of folded into something that's called, they're on Niwot Ridge in Colorado, kind of above the city of Boulder, past Nederland, between Nederland and Ward, on the Colorado Front Range. And up there, there's the National Science Foundation has funded since 1980 something called the Niwot Ridge Long-Term Experimental Research Program. And so these towers now contribute eco-hydrological data to the Niwot Ridge Long-Term Ecological Research Program, which is super cool. So I'm lucky I have a data and field managers, right? So I don't have to go to Colorado all the time, but I still, you know, kind of steer the science of those alpine tundra sites, which is really, really cool. I've been, and I'm still somewhat involved in a site on Mount Bigelow outside of Tucson, Arizona, which is a mixed conifer forest. If anyone's been to Tucson, the Santa Catalina Mountains go up pretty steeply, right, from the north side of town. So this site's at about 8,500 feet. It's a really nice place to work in the Tucson summers because it's much, much cooler. And so kind of a forest site there in Arizona. And then in California, in Northern California, outside of Chico, where I was a professor before, I have one site that's really interesting. It's all the way pretty much around California's Central Valley is oak savanna ecosystem. Much of it is blue oak savanna, which are really cool keystone species, really important to a lot of wildlife. They're fire resistant. They're really good for dendrochronology research. They preserve their rings really well. So I set up a monitoring site, an eddy covariance site, when I was a professor there in the Blue Oak Savannah. And it just so happened within the first year, it was the site was completely burned through by California's Park Fire. Started actually just outside of Chico, burned up into the north, burned through our site, and pretty unbelievably, the entire site was charred, but the instruments never lost power and continued working through the whole thing. So it was probably a pretty fast moving, carried on dry grasses fire that burned through quickly. That was last year. You can see that you know, there was very little tree mortality or anything, right? Everything came back really lush this year. And so that's a really cool natural experiment that we've got going now, right? Like, how do carbon and water exchange from this oak savanna ecosystem before the fire, and how is that affected by this, you know, low intensity fire moving through? So now we're kind of anxiously collecting those data and excited to to draw some conclusions. I also have some flux towers going on in eddy covariance towers. You'll hear me say interchangeably with flux towers. Okay. They measure fluxes of water and CO2 between the surface and atmosphere. So I also have these flux towers going in agriculture systems in California. Maybe we'll talk about this idea of regenerative agriculture later, which was a pretty big grant that some of us got funded to study. And then here in Montana, I've actually, just about a month and a half ago, we turned on a new old eddy covariance tower, which is it's in the Tenderfoot Creek Experimental Forest. It's in the Little Belt Mountains, kind of between White Sulphur Springs and Great Falls. And I say it's a new old tower because Montana State researchers made eddy covariance measurements at this, it's a lodgepole pine forest, at this site from about 2005 to 2012. And then that faculty member moved on and those measurements stopped. And so fast forward to 2024, my first year, I do eddy covariance. I'm interested in all sorts of ecosystems, but mountains and forests are near and dear to my heart. And I hear about there's a 40 meter, so kind of unbelievably tall, I don't know if that's 140 feet tall or something like that, flux tower sitting up in the Tenderfoot Creek Experimental Forest that's all ready to go if I could just slap some new sensors on it. So sure enough, some colleagues and I in September got that site going again. So there's a gap from 2012 to about 2025, but it's going to be great to eventually be able to compare kind of the historical data to the current data in addition to all the other cool research that we have going on. So that's what I've got going in terms of eddy covariance towers around the country. I do hope to, not every eddy covariance tower has to go in for a scientific generation of data collection, depending on your question. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a year, a growing season, targeted measurements is all that we need. And so I'm really excited to make the Tenderfoot Creek site my kind of long-term forest monitoring tower, but also get into especially a lot of agriculture. I'm in the College of Ag here at MSU, and so thinking about ways to get at carbon and water cycling that's relevant to growers and producers around Montana in the future.
What insights can be gathered by analyzing these sites collectively?
Collectively, well, eddy covariance as a field, as a scientific discipline, as a method, has come a long way. So pioneered kind of in the 1980s and 1990s over flat terrain in the Midwest because it measures meteorology and wind. It's best suited for open, flat terrain where there's no obstructions, no irregularities in the airflow. And the method works really well. And the method worked so well that, over time into the 2000s, people started to implement eddy covariance not just over flat or agricultural terrain, right, into more natural ecosystems. There was a network of eddy covariance sites that got formed called the Ameriflux Network, which I'm a part of. And then pushing the envelope as sensor technology improved, sensors became commercially available. And now the Ameriflux Network, which is eddy covariance towers just throughout the Americas, North, Central, and South America, has something like 500 sites that I think are reporting data. I see a tremendous amount of value in comparing eddy flux measurements from all these different sites as a way to gain really the type of process understanding that can't necessarily be measured from one site alone. So I'll give you an example. I measure at a lot of forested sites. Beautiful thing about the Ameriflux network is the majority of the data is available open access. So anybody can create a free account on Ameriflux and download eddy covariance data, right? For their term paper, for their undergrad project, for their graduate school work, or whatever they might be interested in. So I downloaded sites from 6 or 8 forests for a study a few years ago, spanning a gradient from all the way from that forest site down in Arizona. So yeah, it's at 8,500 feet. They get, you know, a shallow snowpack most years, but not every year. It's pretty warm, quite warm during the summer for, you know, mixed conifer vegetation, all the way up to Colorado and Wyoming, right? Where some forests that are at much higher elevation, above 10,000 feet. These are deep snow dominated systems with a much shorter growing season, but really similar types of conifer, evergreen conifer vegetation. And I compared their, I think in this study I was most interested with their carbon fluxes over time. And all these sites had at least 5 and some of them maybe 20 years of data. And so I was able to kind of just compile from the long-term data collection, kind of what does an average year look like for all of these forest sites in terms of forest carbon uptake, right? Photosynthesis. And some really cool patterns emerged along this gradient of mostly temperature, but also the southwestern U.S. gets more monsoon precipitation during the summertime, whereas as you start to get more continental, it kind of peters out. So we have some differences in temperature, we have some differences in precipitation seasonality. We know that climate is changing, we know that things are going to be getting warmer. We don't know as much about precipitation, but even if it doesn't change, if it gets warmer, we'll have less snow. And so kind of doing an analysis to look at, all right, well, we've got these snow-dominated systems. We see a really strong, clear snowmelt pulse of water every year. We see that's followed by a flush of photosynthesis and productivity in the snowmelt season, and that kind of peters out, right, with the summer dry down and things slow down. Well, in the southwestern forests, we saw a much more muted snowmelt pulse, right, of both water and associated productivity, which dried down earlier in the summer, but then was replenished to varying degrees by the monsoon moisture, which kind of kicked things up into a second productivity or photosynthesis peak that trailed off again in the fall. And one of the cool things we weren't necessarily prepared for is the southwestern forests never completely shut off or go dormant in terms of photosynthesis for the winter. And so, right, it's just not cold enough. It, you know, sometimes a cold spell comes through, there's snow and things shut down for a few days. But as soon as the sun comes back out, if you're in Arizona in the mountains, the forests are able to snap back on and start photosynthesizing. And so we're able to, with this comparison, we're able to draw some conclusions or make some predictions that, you know, with climate change progressing at a certain rate, we'd expect by comparing these different systems that more of the forests that we think of kind of in the Rocky Mountains, especially the southern Rocky Mountains, maybe like Colorado, might start behaving more like the forests, mountain forests in Arizona in the future. And that's going to be important for kind of the timing of water inputs in and out and demand when these forests are active and dormant, and really helps us to kind of make predictions to think about testable hypotheses for future work and preparations that we can make for the future.
You were talking, when you were first talking about ecohydrology feedbacks, how these vegetation communities determine how much water reaches maybe anthropogenic communities downstream. So in a situation like that where climate change is posed to shift the productivity of forests in those regions? Mm-hmm. Is that something that would have a major impact on water resource availability for us?
I would say yes, yeah. Definitely. So ecohydrology is really exciting to me because the vegetation and water cycles are inexorably linked through the fact that, you know, vegetation needs water to survive. It uses water, and like I said earlier, whatever it uses is not left over. Mm-hmm. So as an example, one of the things that I've thought a lot about is right here in the Western U.S. our, you know, majority of our water comes from snow, right? We rely on snowpack. We think of it's a really useful exercise, I think, to think of mountains as water towers, right? They store the snow accumulated all winter long when we don't really need it, for certainly for growing or anything like that down here in the valley. And then they release it almost like nature's drip irrigation system, little by little, right, throughout the spring and the summer to feed our streams, our, right, everything that depends on water coming down the mountains, whether it's wildlife or farmers, right, or people that live in communities, right, that depend on water. So when we think about how things might change in the future, if, for example, neglecting any changes in precipitation, we have high confidence that with warming, snow will start to melt earlier in the season, right? We could go into the physics of this, but if snow melt, we can kind of follow this through. If snow starts to melt earlier, right, if peak snow melt shifts from wherever you live, say late May to late April, what we're not so sure about is how the vegetation will respond or over what time scales they might respond to that change. So there's a lot of threads that we could pick up on here, but just in the simplest example, if snow starts to melt earlier and potentially melts before the vegetation has kind of woken up for the spring, it's just going to bypass that vegetation, right? It's sort of sleeping, for lack of a better word. More of it might make it into our soil, water, and ultimately our rivers and our reservoirs and shallow aquifers. But when those trees wake up, there's going to be less of that water available, and they might become drought stressed to a greater degree, to the point that they might not survive all in places, which of course kicks off all sorts of cascading feedbacks. If forests are drought stressed, right, on impacts on all these ecosystem services, to wildlife, to recreation, to all the things that we care about in Montana. So simple changes like the timing of snowmelt are going to be really important for how that snowmelt water is apportioned to vegetation versus soil and streams and the atmosphere.
This has been the first of a two-part episode featuring Dr. John Knowles. Some of our discussion in the next episode will include a definition of the critical zone within land-atmosphere exchange, a past research project Dr. Knowles conducted on bark beetles, and some current work on regenerative agriculture. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found on its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.